KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to the home edition of The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. You may think King of Staten Island is a new documentary about the Wu-Tang Clan. That's not true, although the RZA has been in one of the movies by my guest, Judd Apatow, who's directing his sixth movie to date since 2015. The newest one, again, is The King of Staten Island. My guest is its director and co-writer, Judd Apatow. Judd, good to have you back. How are you?
It's great to be back. I'm hanging in there.
I have no idea what that's like, but let's move on to talking about the movie. And one of the things I said to you, I think maybe one of the last times I saw you, which really applies to this movie, is that you tend to make films as a writer about guys who are stuck between being a boy or basically stepping into manhood, sort of in that, it's caught on the precipice. And this is really a movie about somebody at an age where he has to make that kind of decision, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's about a young man who's in his mid-20s. His father was a firefighter who died in a hotel fire, and his mom is obsessed over taking care of him. He's clearly occasionally suicidal and depressed and on medication. His sister went the other way. She's a hyperachiever who gets great grades, and when she leaves to go to college, his mom decides maybe it's time she could start dating again, and she starts dating a firefighter, which brings up all of his issues and forces him to confront everything that he hasn't dealt with in his life.
Especially because his father was a firefighter who perished when he was a kid.
Yes. In real life, Pete's father died in 9/11 when he was 7 years old. And that was a very traumatic time for him, especially because it was related to 9/11. He talked to me a lot about how it just never went away. There was so much spectacle. People didn't really let a lot of those kids grieve in a normal, healthy way. They would take them to meet the president at the White House or to go to the Giants game or the Yankees game to meet celebrities. And there was an enormous amount of distraction with the good intentions of trying to make all those kids happy. But I think it made it much more complicated for them to sort through what it all meant.
I guess it's an interesting time to release a movie like this, not a movie like this, this movie, given that we're going through a time that's going to end up creating a generation of kids who have to deal with emotional traumas not unlike that one.
I think you're absolutely right. I have two daughters, one's 22 and one's 17. And unfortunately, a big part of their childhood is losing a sense of safety and security. So it's definitely a moment where everybody is feeling traumatized, and the movie is about a young man who is deeply traumatized trying to figure out how he can heal.
But I just think, especially if it's a movie for, and I guess this must feel interesting to you too, a movie about a crisis that young people are going through at the time where similar crisis is happening. That's something we tend to get more on TV nowadays than the movies, isn't it?
I think so. A lot of a certain type of drama has gravitated towards cable and streaming. I think we all have noticed that a certain amount of movies have gone on to become much lower budget. So we have these very expensive movies that are trying to make $1 billion, these big action spectacles. And what we might have called the Sydney Pollack drama, if you will, the well-funded, thoughtful, smart movie, is the type of movie which really is very rare these days. I think the reason why people got so excited about 1917 and also the Quentin Tarantino movie was because it was in the world of a kind of movie that we used to get all the time.
Well, it's funny you're saying these things, because one of the things I'm going to mention to you, and I know we talked about this before, but the fact is that you make movies that if you were to turn them in half a click to the left, they would be melodrama. And in fact, they are. I've always thought of them as being comedy melodrama, and that's the kind of movie that is almost always rested in the indie world anyway, just because it, in some ways, kind of defies an easy categorization, doesn't it?
That's true. And I have to say that I just prefer the versions of those that have some degree of humor. I just feel like they're dishonest or mopey if they're not pretty funny. For instance, I thought that Marriage Story, the Noah Baumbach film, succeeded so well because it was also hysterical at times. Its drama worked perfectly, but there were scenes that were riotously funny, and there was a lot of humor in the heartbreak of it. I think that might have been the funniest thing I've ever seen Alan Alda do. The scene where Adam Driver cuts himself, I found to be remarkable. It was just perfect. And a lot of what I have always liked best is, you know, shows like The Sopranos, because yes, it's a drama, it's about mobsters, but to me, it's a dark comedy. And I always appreciate something that is a mixture of drama and comedy.
We're talking about shaking up the test tube with my guest, Judd Apatow, who hasn't been here for a while. His new film is The King of Staten Island. And I guess as we're talking about this too, also this the idea that you take what in effect are kind of working autobiographies from most of these people that you've had starring in these movies. I mean, be it, we could say certainly that there's some bits of Adam Sandler in Funny People, and certainly some parts of Amy Schumer in Trainwreck, and parts of Pete's life here too. And I just wonder, are there just certain moments that you are on the set, you just wonder, you say, how do I thread this needle? Because I'm asking these people to expose a lot about themselves.
That's always the type of movie I've been attracted to. When I was a kid, I think one of the most influential movies for me was Diner. And that was based on Barry Levinson's childhood. I'm not sure if any of it was real or not real, but I always heard it was a personal movie, one of several that he made like that. And I loved Fast Times at Ridgemont High because it was based on a book that Cameron Crowe wrote where he went undercover and went back to high school. And when things feel real like that, I find them to hit me harder emotionally. It feels like a band that has a song that's personal, and you could tell they're not just trying to have a hit, they're trying to tell you something. I loved working with Lena Dunham on Girls. I as time goes by, I realize what an inspiration she was to me, just watching her work and taking her life and turning it into all those stories. And of course, Gary Shandling with The Larry Sanders Show. He hosted The Tonight Show as a fill-in. But he made a show that imagined what he might have been like if he did become someone like Johnny Carson. And he wasn't exactly that person. So it was partially Gary, but also partially, you know, this egomaniacal talk show host, which might have been, you know, the dark side of Gary.
But also, I mean, was knowing him a little bit, certainly he was somebody, and all these people we're talking about are in some ways prone to self-examination and wondering what they're doing at some point during their careers. And I have to say, there's one moment in the movie that really struck me in King of Staten Island is when he's sitting, sort of in the crow's nest on the fire truck. And I wonder what it was like to shoot that, because that's really bringing his fictional life, his real life, into collision with each other for Pete Davidson.
There's a scene where he is hanging around this man, played by Bill Burr, who's dating his mom, who's played by Marisa Tomei, and he doesn't like this man, and he gets called to a fire, and Pete goes on a ride-along with him, and I think that was probably the most difficult sequence for Pete to shoot, because he had to get in the fire truck and drive all across town and then watch them put out a fire, and Pete said that's something he had never seen or done in his life, and that watching it, even a fictional version of it, he said it reminded him of what his dad did. But the part that was most powerful for him wasn't imagining something happening to his father. He said that what he thought about was how much his dad loved doing it, that was what he wanted to spend his time doing. He was dedicated to saving people. He was dedicated to putting his life at risk to be there for other people. And he said he was bummed while we shot that sequence, but mainly bummed because his dad didn't get to do it anymore.
It's funny because I guess one of the things I find myself thinking about too, especially with your last two features between Trainwreck and Staten Island, is getting stand-ups to act. And what's interesting, because I've talked to directors who've done this before, and they said nobody can deliver a line like a stand-up, but the thing that can be problematic is getting them to pay attention to other people, because they're so used to being having to take care of themselves, and it becomes a kind of an armor around them. And I guess what I'm really struck by in watching Pete in this movie is that he has the concentration of an actor.
I agree. I really think he was born to do this above everything else that he does. He is a natural actor. He's very gifted. He's very present. And when I directed him, I used to joke with him that he doesn't have the ability not to be in the moment. He's not someone that's sitting there with a script saying, on this line, I'll yell. And on this line, I'll remind myself that I feel sad. He's not preparing in that way. He's completely throwing himself into the reality of the moment. And he's great at taking direction and tuning it in. And we would rehearse a lot, and we talked about how the scenes would work, and he co-wrote all the scenes. But when it would go down and he was with somebody like Marissa Tomei and he had to be vulnerable, he was right there. And there were definitely moments that felt like, we're not even shooting a movie right now. We're really shooting Pete opening up in a very real way to Marissa, but you could feel he's talking to his real mom and he's sharing something very personal and important to him.
No, that's why I was saying that thing about an actor's concentration, because he's really aware and paying attention, and not just paying attention so he can score or basically be, we see his anxiety because he has to take care of himself. He's really paying attention to what's going on. I really noticed that there's a scene where he's working as a busboy in a restaurant, and he runs into his semi sort of ex-girlfriend on a date. And that's a scene that's as good as anything you've ever done. And that's because of his attention in that, where he's not quite sure who he should be, what he should be. And that's the kind of thing that really made me aware of his gift as an actor.
I agree. I think that he, he's a very special person, and he showed a lot of courage to open up like this and to make himself emotionally available in this way. It wasn't hard for me to get this out of him. It was very, very natural for him. And it's tough stuff. You know, he's really talking about what it feels like to be broken and to want to do better, but not being sure you can, and wondering if you'll ever feel healed enough to be the type of person you want to be. And I thought it took a lot of strength to expose that. You don't really see people talk about that. Pete wanted to write about the fact that his mom had taken such good care of him his entire life, and how he felt guilty that she just had given him so much and that he had made her so nervous. And in a way, the main reason he made the movie was as a thank you to his mom and a tribute to his mom for taking such good care of him and his sister.
Well, I guess it's sometimes a little interesting to watch, and harrowing, I think, because you're watching somebody clearly play what is his nightmare version of his own life.
Yeah, this is like a version of his life if he didn't find comedy. When Pete was 16, he's living on Staten Island, he's not doing well, and his friends are beginning to get in a little more trouble. There's, some low-level drug selling happening. Kids are beginning to have problems taking drugs. And Pete made this choice to be a stand-up comedian. And at 16, he started escaping that life and going to the city and going to open mic nights. And by the time he was 20, he was on Saturday Night Live. So he's a very driven, ambitious artist, where this character is someone that is a half about wanting to be a tattoo artist one day. He's just smoking pot and not believing in himself. And that is actually very different from Pete. He talks about that being maybe a version of himself from when he was younger.
Well, there's obviously a lot to talk about here. My guest is the director of The King of Staten Island, our old friend Judd Apatow, who hasn't been around for a while, and he's still not around because I'm not even sure we're in the same zip code right now. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? Critics rave The Greatest Hits is a music-infused romance that hits all the right notes and the most original time travel story in years. Featuring music by Nelly Furtado, Beach House, Jamie XX, and more. Watch The Greatest Hits, now streaming on Hulu.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. My guest, Judd Apatow, I think is still here. Are you still there, Judd, somewhere?
I'm right here.
Thank you for the pause. Thank you for making me sweat. His new film as director and co-writer and producer and everything else is The King of Staten Island. And I guess I was wondering, too, this film felt a little personal to you in a way, because in a lot of ways you guys are similar, right down to him being kind of a comedy prodigy. And I wonder if you felt that kind of a connection with him when you first met him on Trainwreck.
I think so. And I think a lot of that is sometimes unconscious. You know how people say, you know, you'll date one person and then you realize that that's the exact wrong type of person for you. And then you'll date someone else. You're sure they're completely different than that last one. And then you realize you have found the exact same person. I feel like we all have an unconscious way of finding each other. We have a radar, for what we need or what taps into our brokenness. And I was somebody who found comedy as a teenager. It felt like a way to survive and escape. And Pete and I definitely share that. I certainly have suffered with my insecurities and anxiety in life. And that is why I made The 40-Year-Old Virgin. You know, the last few projects I've done have been about anxiety and depression and people who have suicidal ideation. I produced a stand-up special for Chris Gethard called Career Suicide. That's on HBO, and another one on HBO with Gary Goldman called The Great Depression. So clearly it's on my mind, and I feel like all that work informed my ability to collaborate with Pete and understand enough to help him get this story out.
I guess I was asking that just because that the last few movies you've done have been about people who are kind of passive-aggressive, sort of self-destructive people, and if they can't really sort of finish themselves off, then they'll put themselves in situations where they ruin the lives of people around them. And I thought that interestingly becomes part of this thing too, doesn't it?
That's definitely an element of it, which is, you know, when you're suffering, a part of your suffering is that you are aware that you might be a burden on the people around you who are trying to take care of you. And I think that's, you know, a torturous part of it for many people, because they don't want their loved ones to be sad. They don't want their loved ones to be concerned. And Pete talked a lot about that in how it relates to his mom, who has really dedicated her life to making sure that he was feeling strong and doing well. And for him, making this movie and writing this movie was a very cathartic experience. As an observer, I think what has helped him heal, and I feel like he's really doing so well, is because he not only wrote for himself, but he wrote his mom's character. He wrote his sister's character. And so he really had to step into their shoes and write scenes where he understands how they perceive him, how it's affected them. And I think looking at it through all sorts of different lenses has helped him see it and I think melt a lot of it. And has been very, very positive.
Yeah, but I do think, though, that finding somebody like Pete, who, again, is a young guy and now still, but was a very young when he got into this, and to also to be that young and to find this thing that really you want to attach yourself to and to prove that you're good at it, I mean, that's going to create a series of complications that maybe only a handful of people can understand, and you'd be one of them.
Yeah, that's true. And I think it's more complicated now. You know, when I started, there was no social media. There was no internet. If there was, only the military was using it. And we were able to learn our craft without almost anyone paying attention. We, you know, went out on dates and had girlfriends, and no one in the world paid attention. I think that it's such a different environment for young artists, where your life becomes a soap opera that everybody follows on their phones and on the internet. And it creates a much higher level of pressure than we ever had to deal with.
Yeah, but the way this movie is sort of set up in a weird way, it almost feels like it's a period piece. I mean, there's not a whole lot of talk about people talking about social media or anything. And I thought that was interesting, too, because almost it's like Scott, his character, has kind of chosen to sequester himself away from the modern world in some ways.
I definitely think that these characters don't feel connected to the culture and what's happening. You know, Staten Island is an interesting place because the people who live there, some people commute, but a lot of people just stay there and they don't leave that much. And Pete always said that when he was young, you would only go to the city if you were, you know, going to like see the Christmas tree in Rockefeller Center. It wasn't a thing he did all the time. He said he might go a year without going to Manhattan. It was 15 minutes away. And people don't really visit Staten Island unless they have friends there or relatives, because there's nothing there like an amusement park or a concert hall or, you know, a sports team that you would travel there for. So it is its own bubble. And I don't think that, you know, there's a ton of feeling that they're connected to, you know, the larger culture in a giant way, like someone might feel if they lived in Los Angeles or Manhattan.
I ask you all these things too, just because I find myself wondering about, again, getting stand-ups who, you've known them your entire career, you talk to a lot of them, you've interviewed probably way more than I ever have. And there does often tend to be this kind of armor, because when I've talked to stand-ups who've done the movie, they say, well, you know, I felt like I had to go and prepare because I don't know what this is. I don't know this director. These actors are different people than me. I've got to watch out for myself. And that's giving yourself a special kind of challenge to get them to relax enough to act.
It really depends on who you're working with. Amy Schumer had studied acting with William Esper, so I was really thrilled when I first started working with her on the scenes that she just knew exactly what she was doing. You know, Adam Sandler graduated from NYU as a drama major, so, you know, he's very strong. And then there are people who haven't done much of it, and they just naturally take to it, because so much of it is just relaxing and not trying too hard. And I feel like there's a lot of people who just have such interesting personalities, and if they could just relax, they can really be fun to watch. You know, there are definitely people who are, you know, a bit sweaty, but usually it's the director's fault. I've rarely found that someone's terrible and there's no way to pull them out of it. I think with a few simple directions, most people can be startlingly good.
For example, well, how do you communicate to people who do come in with kind of, you know, tacky palms and are looking around? You can always tell those people in movies because they're the ones whose eyes are constantly moving.
I think that the key is you have to make them feel like there's going to be a lot of takes and a lot of time to get it right. I think most of that sweatiness is because no one's communicating with you. So you go on a set and you're about to start acting, and you don't know if you're going to get one shot at it or three or 25. And if you say to almost any actor or actress, hey, we're just going to goof around, we're going to take plenty of time, don't stress, it doesn't even matter if we get it right for a while, let's just start playing, you could just see them relax and breathe easier. I do think it's that question of how long am I going to get to do this, which is the main drive of terror.
Well, also, too, that's the thing, because so many people who come onto movie sets are aware of the fact that, you know, it's like the world's most expensive parking meter, that time is constantly running.
Yes.
And to be able to communicate that to people so that they don't feel that pressure. Did you have an instinct for that right away, or is it something you learned over the course of making movies?
I learned it over the years, because the most important thing I can provide a movie as a result of us having some successful movies is more days to shoot, so we don't have to rush. So we shot this movie in 53 days. A lot of people would have tried to shoot this movie in 35 days or 40 days, but that extra 10 or 15 days is the difference between rushing or not rushing. It's the ability to improvise and play and discover the material. And to me, that seems to be the most important element to helping, you know, magical things happen. You can't get a lot of the stuff you dream of getting if people have two shots at it, and then you just got to run.
Well, I know that's somebody we've talked about here before, and I really felt an influence of him on this movie just again because the cast being so varied is Todd Solondz. And, you know, those things we're talking about comedy and melodrama, and sometimes with his films, the melodrama is so awful that you can't help but laugh at it a little bit. And then there's something about that kind of feeling of not quite having a footing as an audience member, which creates a tension that's what comedians do that I feel like you have an interest in as well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, his work is so fantastic. You know, Happiness and Welcome to the Dollhouse, were big inspirations, early in my career. You know, I love Nicole Holofcener's work. I look back and think that Walking and Talking had a big effect on me in terms of human drama and comedy. I like stories that are just about everyday things. That's the main thing that interests me. And the more I do it, the more I realize, sometimes all you need for a movie is a guy who has to meet his mom's new boyfriend and can they like each other? And there's nothing more important in life than whether or not they like each other and open their hearts to each other. And that dance of, do we like each other or hate each other? Are we going to resist each other? Is also hysterical. That's the thing that Shandling always found so funny, obstacles to love.
But it's also this thing that runs that was in Larry Sanders that's in a lot of your movies too, is just letting time pass out in a way that makes it feel like real time rather than it's movie time. You know, that we're not on the clock.
That's true. I'm not a big fan in my own directing of pushing things forward and cutting and popping around and one line here and two lines there. I love it in other people's movies. I know there's a lot of people that's exactly right for their aesthetic. But for me, I like seeing how people sniff each other out. I like to see the moment when someone wants to say something and they're afraid to, and then they finally get it out. And then there's an explosion. There's a sequence earlier in the movie where Pete's sister, played by my daughter Maude, gives him a set of paints the night before she's leaving for college. And he doesn't understand why. And she says, because you want to be a tattoo artist. I wanted to, expand your horizons. And he's instantly offended. And then it becomes about, are you going to be nice to mom when I'm gone? Are you going to go easy on her? And he starts making jokes and scary jokes and jokes about hurting himself. And next thing you know, they're just having a vicious fight and they're screaming at each other. And you realize that this is what their relationship is that she's trying hard to be nice, to give her mom a break. And he's taking up all the air in the house and causing problems and stressing out their mother. And this is why they don't get along. She's chosen to be easy and he's flailing. And I want to see all the beats of that. I don't want to cut into that for 40 seconds. I want to see how all that plays out from the walk-in to the slam of the door.
Speaking of slamming of the door, I guess I got to do that now. The world's worst transition, but we're out of time.
I don't like it. I don't like it. Elvis, I don't like it. I don't like it. I don't want it.
Let's fight again right now. Let's go. Come on.
Don't do it. I didn't get to thank you for my Simpsons episode, so I just want to say thank you again because you asking me what the story was for the Simpsons episode I wrote when I was a young aspiring writer led to the Simpsons calling me saying, you know what, we'll make it now 22 years later. And that was a great thing. And thank you.
Well, that's very kind of you. But when I first asked you that question about you writing about these characters who are caught at that precipice between remaining an adolescent, no matter how old they are, or becoming an adult. And you said, well, that was my Simpsons episode that I wrote. So, it's always nice if somebody has the thesis statement. Again, you're welcome here anytime, Jeff. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Alice.
Recording engineer who also mixes and edits the show, so she clearly has a lot of free time on her hands, is Kat Yore. I'm Elvis Mitchell. To better days, everybody. It's The Treatment. Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.